Welcome to our newest adventure for first responder wellness. No one fights alone. In-depth conversations about mental health and culture in the first responder space. We're joined by your co-hosts, Austin Pedersen and Brad Shepard.
Welcome back to another episode of No One Fights Alone. Today we are lucky because it's just me and Ben, and we're going to be talking on some pretty interesting points. I think that this is a topic that, in one way or another, a majority of families have experienced this, and it's impacted them, you know, pretty deeply. So it is Suicide Prevention Month. Did I say that right, Ben?
That's correct.
Okay.
September,
yep. I know I was joking with Ben earlier because at the beginning of the year, we had talked about doing all of these specialty month things, and then when we looked, each different list says each month is a different thing. But this one's pretty national, so I think we got it right this time. But Ben, you've been on the podcast before. Give a little introduction to yourself for those who don't know you.
Yeah, thanks for having me. Been with the Chateau for the last almost 11 years. Mental health professional, been doing this for about 22 years. And again, we specialize in working with first responders, their families, focusing on mental health, substance abuse, and just overall health. But yeah, happy to be here.
So I think this is a key point because we're talking about it a little bit earlier. Suicide has become somewhat of a hot topic in the last couple of years comparatively to, say, when you started, right, 22 years ago. I mean, you knew about it and you talked about it, but like as a community, it was a pretty hush-hush conversation. And I think the last few years, it's really changed to where it is not only being researched quite a bit more, but also being addressed quite a bit more in individuals and families. Talk about some of the key contributors to someone struggling with suicidal ideation.
Yeah, I think you're right. There's an element of this conversation. And since, you know, social media has such a huge impact on our general culture, there is a megaphone been placed at the mouth of mental health kind of concerns. And so I think what used to be a secret or this kind of awkward or avoidant sort of conversation out there, there's a very different tone in our culture, and people are acknowledging it, discussing it. Sometimes it's this attention-seeking sort of process that kind of can grind on people's nerves a little bit. But there's a lot of more attention drawn to how miserable people can be sometimes. And so as we talk about contributors to, you know, to suicide, we are talking about a wide range of things. And one of the parts that we talk about at the Chateau is these six different dimensions of health, and that people are not just a list of symptoms, but they have an internal system. And so when we talk about mental health or suicide or employment or identity, the reality is we're talking a lot about family and your physical health and all these other dimensions of health that really are relevant. And when we do that, we get to find out that there's a lot of other kind of nooks and crannies of this human system that have been suffering and struggling for a while. And I think when we get people talking about mental health, especially talking about suicide, we start to put together this picture of this cumulative experience that people might have stress and concern and possibly trauma in 10 or 12 parts of their lives, not just this one thing happened at work. And that kind of used to be the popular opinion of why people struggle with trauma, is there's this one event and that event altered their brain or altered their experience. And what we know now through some research, as well as just a much broader conversation, is that the reality is that people, all of us, walk away from experiences with all sorts of beliefs and residue of the experiences that are just with us. And we don't always know where they kind of end up later on in our lives. So as we talk about suicide, it's not uncommon for people to talk about depression, anxiety, and how they have kind of developed over time. But these are issues that a lot of our responders talk about, and they have really not had a solution for any of these things for years and years. And when you have hundreds or thousands of small depressive ideas about how worthless you are, or about how pointless this world can be sometimes, or how emotionally unstable you feel, or how unregulated you might be, you add those pieces together, add it on top of what might be some shame or misunderstanding around grief, as we talk about people just being pretty unhappy and lacking the skills to articulate what's going on for them. Add that on top of whatever aches and pains that you have in your body. Some might be from the job. Some might just be from the challenge of just getting older. Add that to whatever financial stress and debt you may have accumulated that you've attempted to kind of manage the symptoms.
Yeah.
I mean, the list starts to get pretty big.
Yeah. I think in a way that made sense for me is especially when I was younger or just learning about, you know, a close friend, right, at age 20 of mine. I think all of our thoughts were surrounded, like, what big event happened,
right,
that was the catalyst,
right,
for this action, for someone to take their own life. And what you're talking about is something that I think, you know, everyday people don't think about, which is it's just not that.
Right.
It's just not one event. Now, it could be, you know, in rare situations, but I think a majority of the time you're talking about just this cumulative attack for years and years and years. You're talking about aches and pains. You're talking about little tiny moments that develop over 20 years that push someone to that point. And that's just not a normal way of thinking when you're not in the behavioral health space.
Yeah, there's a pretty human experience where we crave simple. We want there to be a single event that can be the cause. I know how to now, you know, I can now, you know, avoid it, fix it. That's a very attractive concept because the alternative is a little overwhelming.
Mm-hmm.
The reality is I've been neglecting lots of little things. I've been avoiding. I've been lying. I've been covering up. I just may not be as good at adulting as I thought I was going to be at this point. And so it is attractive to think of there's this one thing, this one person, or this one comment that happened that really offended me and sent me into a tailspin. When the reality is, we just might not be as healthy as we need to be.
Yeah. Well, it goes into everything, right? You talk about systems. I mean, it's even like diet has been shown.
Sure.
It's a huge contributing factor to depression.
Right.
And just not being physically healthy, like, Matt, you know, overweight, whatever it could be, like, you know, those are the key contributing factors to you. I don't like the way that I look anymore. And then my wife left me.
Right.
And then your people use that person leaving as the the reason they thought someone.
Totally. Yeah. And these kind of situations are all over in our lives, right? This person in front of me in traffic is an idiot. That's why I have anger problems.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I think this is a joke with a lot of our responders is that they stay in this spot for a while. And again, some of these things start out pretty innocently, but they eventually evolve into a pretty sad, discouraged, negative outlook on the world and on ourselves. And it's really tough. None of us are trained to show up one day and say, I'm pretty unhappy. I don't like me very much. I don't like the way I solve problems. I don't like the way I do all sorts of stuff. We live in a culture that rewards convenience and rewards blame. And so we don't have a lot of great options. And so when people are in this spot where they do go to these quick fixes of avoidance or control or blame and building up all these defenses, they don't in the moment recognize how offensive or combative, or even just difficult they're being in those moments, and then they find themselves alone and isolated. And so, and this is the story that we talk about all the time in treatment is good people trying really hard to solve what they think the problem is, mm-hmm. not recognizing how trauma or trauma responses work. And next thing you know, they have pushed everyone away. They've isolated, they've numbed, they've been in this spot that's a little confusing for their families to kind of navigate, because when you're in this kind of spot, you're typically giving people a lot of bad information yeah. about what actually is happening for you.
Yeah.
And so when they go down this road, family is pulling out their hair. That's my joke for two bald guys having a conversation on podcast.
I used it yesterday.
Oh, that's yeah. good. That's yeah. good. But I mean, the reality is the family's just overwhelmed. They're discouraged. And there they are trying really hard just to get the truth. And there's so much shame and stigma about the truth. And the truth is I've been out of control for a while. I've been winging it for a while. I've been avoiding a bunch of things for a while. And really kind of what I'm going with this is that we accidentally back ourselves into a very high-risk situation. And when you add that, especially in the first responder world, when you add that to high demands, you know, constant exposure to vicarious issues, as well as just death, carnage, violence, and those kinds of things, with almost no chance to recover or to process any of these events, the little hope that you might have had, those dark moments come up more and more often in a culture that often has access to some pretty lethal means. And so what happens for people, for a lot of people, not everybody, is that they get themselves into a dark, hopeless spot, not seeing decent options, not seeing opportunities, not seeing support, as they are oftentimes literally right in front of them. And then they get to this little window of opportunity. And in that window, which is sometimes, you know, 10, 15 minutes, sometimes even shorter than that, those are the moments where they're just not thinking right. They may or may not be intoxicated. And then they end up making some decisions that really is not about suicide, but they're just in this high risk, desperate spot. And they make decisions that are obviously catastrophic.
Well, I think you gave me this stat actually, so correct me if I'm wrong, but it's something along the line of 80% of completion of suicide is actually a 10-minute window of yeah. impulsivity.
Right.
And can you talk on that? Because I found that particular fact extremely fascinating.
Yeah, it's pretty wild, because these are folks who are not trying to commit suicide. These are folks who can identify that there's good people, good opportunities. It is a really out of the norm moment for them. But when these contributing factors, again, left unmanaged, or they just don't have any skills or support in those moments, yeah, they end up in this really high intensity, dark place. And when they have been to that place before and have no idea how to get themselves out of it, they end up believing part of what depression tells us is that, you know, you're going to get screwed either way. There is no hope. This is not going to ever get better. And so in those narrow little windows, that's where we see people making lots of decisions. And we understand now, as we look at it from a trauma lens, that this is a pretty dysregulated moment that is outside of their window of tolerance. Mm-hmm. And they're in the extremes of the human experience. But in those spots, the reality is your brain is not working the way it needs to be. And you can't see any relevance with nutrition or working out or asking for help or suffering the humiliation of acknowledging that you're just not where you need to be. There's those kinds of things that put people in this spot where they're just not in a healthy place. And yeah, if they have access, they end up doing some things that are obviously horrible.
Well, and I think for people that are listening that may have had a family member, I think that had completed suicide, I think there's this conversation that surrounds when somebody finally has the balls to say in their mind, right? Mm-hmm. You didn't see it coming? Mm. You know, like I've heard that particular conversation from people that have had a loved one take their life, that they're like, no, I did not see it coming. And right. they don't believe me.
Right.
And that's where that impulsivity comes in.
Right.
Right.
Yeah. No, and that's what I do like that's happening socially, is that there are more conversations of this is a good person. This is not a moral deficit. This is mm-hmm. not all of the, you know, for a lot of years, there was, you know, suicide was considered a sin. And it was looked at from this...
Selfish.
Yeah, pretty selfish, a pretty disconnected understanding about how it works. The good news is I think there is more awareness now that says this is good people just looking for relief.
Mm-hmm.
And I like that that's also come into the world of substance abuse as well as alcoholism, that there are good people trying their damnedest to figure out how to make this work. And they don't have access to all of the tools that are out there. And in some cases, they have all the access to the tools they could ever want. And the reality is that this doesn't fit, doesn't work right.
Yeah.
So I do think there is some attempts out there to kind of diminish some of that shame and isolation. But going back to the families for a little bit, families are obviously just devastated.
Yeah.
Overwhelmed.
Terrible.
And the guilt of I should have seen it is mm-hmm. incredibly high. Or, again, which is very common in families where there's trauma and suffering, there is this over sense of responsibility of I was supposed to do something, fix something, anticipate something, read someone's mind. And I see lots of families add really pretty unnecessary pain to their grief as they try and rehash all the things that should have, would have, could have happened if they would have magically known these things. Obviously, that doesn't do us a ton of good in the big picture.
Years. They go through years and years of memories and was this the moment? Was this the moment
that,
you know, I should have stepped in and done something?
Yeah, we've had suicide in my family, and as we've gone through and talked about some things, every person, it's funny, you know, for my family, it's been over 12 years since the suicide had happened, and everyone still has loads of their own kind of personal conspiracy theories of what I should have done differently.
Yeah.
And I think there's, again, unfortunately, part of the human experience is we would prefer to blame ourselves or to believe some pretty irrational ideas than have to acknowledge that we're pretty powerless and we don't have the control we'd prefer to have. But the part that's really poisonous about that is we end up walking around with this over sense of responsibility and some really magical thinking that really... We should just get more control in the next situation.
Mm-hmm.
We really should just push our way around or lecture people or take away their choices. In our desperateness to not feel pain, family members unintentionally end up, ironically, pushing their loved ones away because they really hope that something bad doesn't happen.
That's, oh man, that is, and I know so many situations when I'm looking at it, like the... parent will do that to a child.
Totally.
And then the child becomes resentful. But the parent is doing it from a deep place of love, of like,
totally.
I cannot let this happen again.
Right.
When really it wasn't their responsibility, but they took it on. So
yep.
now the overbearing, protecting, you know, can't let them out of their sight kind of.
Right. Parents really have a hard time looking at like, oh, that's my own mental health issues.
Yeah. Yeah.
that's my kid's behavior is definitely reminding me of a number of issues that I haven't resolved in my personal life, but that's tough because in moments where we see our family members suffering, we want to do what we can, and sometimes we forget what would I want when I'm tired, discouraged, isolated, depressed, and we forget that, and sometimes we just need a little reminder that hey, they don't need any magical intervention. This is maybe not the time for a professional quite yet. They just need to know that we give a shit, that we've been there, that they're not weird, they're not alone, that overall we're all suffering, we're all struggling, not to the point where we try and overshadow their experience with how hard our life is, but the reality is there's lots of just more humanizing, connecting moments that we can have that actually help that person see that this isn't as bad as I thought it was.
Yeah, I think it's one of those where they'll get their child, you know, therapy, but they won't go for themselves kind of a thing.
Yeah, unfortunately. Yeah, that's very common.
Yeah. So, I mean, talk a little bit about some of the clients that you've seen over the years and kind of what they're seeing, whether it's their own suicidal ideation, they're experiencing a coworker or a family member. Talk a little bit about that.
Yep. There's been a few that stood out. I can't think of the last time I didn't have a client in the building that didn't have a coworker that has completed suicide.
Mm-hmm. Agreed.
And there's a few that stands out more recently that they have had coworkers reach out to them on some level to either announce their impending suicide, which is really, really tough. There are some that have obviously found their coworkers or have responded to calls. There's some pretty horrible scenarios where, your two worlds collide a little bit. So the part that they've talked about in treatment is probably some shame and some embarrassment of not noticing some of those signs. And again, it's really tough because in the first responder world, especially when it comes to shift work, it is go, go, go constantly. And there is very little time set aside to do these follow-up conversations of how are you actually doing. You have to do that basically off shift.
Yeah.
A lot of regret of why didn't I take a minute? Why didn't I follow up? Why didn't I just say what's going on? Some of them have had some very positive success stories of someone did pull me aside and just said, I'm worried about you. And almost all of them say, and I lie to them.
Yeah.
As soon as it
happens.
That's
the go-to. Yeah.
And I tell them that I'm fine, that I'm good, and that I am going to dedicate, tons of my energy to making sure I maintain this image. A dishonest image. And most of them acknowledge, like, I still am kind of pissed that they didn't see through my lie and kind of call me out and catch me in it. But they recognize that they've been struggling in that spot for a while. So as they come to treatment, they do have experiences and stories that are incredibly intense, very sad. And they often didn't understand how much grief was a part of their life at home. As they talk about their personal experience and thoughts around suicide, most of them get to this place where they just didn't have a chance to slow down in a process. And it usually isn't until they get to a treatment experience where they start to say, if I, again, do the math, I've had some pretty dark assumptions about the world, about my safety since I've been a little kid. And when, I encountered other forms of pain, disappointment, rejection in my adult life, pushed me further and further to a place of I don't have hope. A lot of them don't have faith anymore. They don't understand or connect with anything higher than them. And so they end up spinning in this incredibly negative process. And when their buddies are struggling, unfortunately, all they have is negativity to share.
Or let's go have a drink.
Yeah, fuck it.
Yeah.
I don't want to deal with it. She's wrong. She's stupid. This kid's ungrateful. Unfortunately, their conclusions or their ideas about problem solving are just in a very dark place. And so they offer a lot of regret of, my buddy needed me. He was struggling. Now looking back, I can see all sorts of signs. I can see how he was just as miserable as me. And we were both just commiserating together at the bar or some other spot. And I don't know if I actually helped them very much, but he was asking for some kind of support.
Yeah. I think there's that terminal uniqueness kind of thing.
Sure.
Is the thought process before.
Right.
To where it's like, nobody is like me. No one thinks like me.
Yep.
No one understands me.
Anything I share is going to be a burden.
Yeah.
No one has any room. Everyone's as overwhelmed as I am. And no one has the time or energy to kind of manage whatever mess I am. And if I point to mine, that's just gonna make their life harder.
Yeah. No one's marriage is like mine. No one's kid is like mine.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Welcome to one of the biggest lights that turn on to people, usually in the first 48 hours when they get to the program. They meet people and they're like, wait a second. You guys are all like me.
Yeah, and you're from different parts of the country.
Yeah.
Different, departments, different cultures.
Right.
You can't even talk about how different some of the cultures are from West Coast to East Coast, right?
Right. Wildly different. But the fascinating part is here we all are with mm-hmm. some very common core beliefs about people and humanity and family life. And I think there is immediately for those folks that probably speak up and acknowledge or point to it, which I think takes a ton of courage. Pointing to I need some help, whether it's with substances or whether it's with my mental health. Anytime we kind of betray this voice in our head that tells us we should hide, I think that takes a ton of courage. But when they do it, what I love watching is people being rewarded by validation.
Yeah.
And by acknowledgement and support. And there is someone saying, like, boy, I've been there for years too.
Well, that's the first step, but it seems to be the hardest step.
Oh, it's massive. Yeah. Yeah.
And it takes years.
Right.
Most likely to get there. I think actually, to as we've worked with some of the next generation of first responders, that is happening a little bit earlier.
It is. It's really, that could be a whole different conversation. Yes. Because yes. I think it's fascinating how these newer folks under 10 years in law enforcement, for example, the old school is just like, these kids are bitching too much.
Yeah.
Even though they will turn around in the next sentence and say, I wish I would have spoke up when I was younger.
Yep. Shocking. Yeah. Yeah.
You can't ever do it right. So yeah, I think there's a lot of folks that get here and recognize there's this cumulative experience. Like, I've made a lot of small choices, or I've just been exposed to, or just life happened and lots of small little cuts have occurred. And, all of them have been minimized. All of them have been kind of justified. And we rationalize how that's really not that big of a deal and that's going to be a burden on people. When they get here, they start to do the math and recognize, wow, anyone on the street that has this many thousands of cuts probably has a legitimate claim that they actually should be taken seriously. And they are legitimately hurting. But oftentimes when you're in the middle of the funk, that's just not a piece of grace that we usually give ourselves.
Do you think that that's, you know, we'll obviously get more into some solution-based conversation as we go further, but I mean, do you think that that's probably the first step in healing, is understanding that there are others that are experiencing the same thing?
I think so. I mean, it's I've heard a lot of different things that have as I think about it, it's We're all kind of on this little treadmill of suffering, to borrow a couple of Buddhist concepts.
Yeah, yeah.
And I'm always amazed by it's very different for different people about what snaps them out of it. And I talk about in groups and stuff when I discuss mine, I am incredibly comfortable being busy, distracted, and just preoccupied with myself, right? Not in a very creative way, just the usual dumb shit that I know is probably not working very well for me. I can get in that, and it's not until I finally notice someone else's suffering that I finally think, where the heck have I been?
For like months.
Yeah, for a long, long time.
I'm just thinking about my own self. I was speaking for myself.
It's true. You can talk about me. It's true.
No, but I was speaking for myself there on that one. Yeah.
Right. But I think that's... It's not until we see someone really struggling that we finally just snap out of it and think, oh, there's a whole other experience out there.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that is one of the little wedges that gets into the conversation of, wow, there's something bigger or something outside of my own ego that really needs to be addressed. And when we start to deviate from the normal routine of me, my suffering is more. None of us wake up in the morning thinking, I'm going to be as self-centered as possible today. I'm going to be constantly preoccupied by my own stress. I don't think we consciously do that. We oftentimes are just kind of pulled into this gravitational negativity, sometimes culturally, sometimes it's in our houses and our marriages and that kind of stuff. But there's got to be something that really kind of jolts us out of that fog and helps us consider that there's another conversation out there and that someone else is struggling. But what I've seen is when that happens, and sometimes it is the courageous family member that speaks up and just says, I can't deal with you anymore. Mm. Or maybe it is that moment where, you know, your kid's just like, I don't like you. I don't want to be around you.
Yeah, what a painful thing to hear. Right?
Yeah. Yeah. But I've never heard of a comfortable thing jolting us out of the toilet bowl. But it is, if we're not in a spot where we can actually see it for what it is, we end up just getting back into this defensive, guarded, reactive sort of spot. So as we talk about suicide and people suffering, the reality is, you have to kind of be looking for it. Or it's going to have to be something pretty jarring that kind of slaps us in the face and helps us wake up to it. So as we talk about, again, moving towards the solution conversation, we just have to get outside of our own head. And sometimes that's not easy. Because the voice in our head tells us that it's the only right interpretation of the world. It's the only thing that's keeping us safe. And that we need to be as focused and preoccupied with ourselves. And that's the only way this is ever going to get better. Mm-hmm. And we do have this misconception at times that if I just have more control or things just go more my way, that's how I'm going to stay safe. And that's how I'm going to be happy eventually. Even though it's the opposite of what typically happens.
Yeah. You talked about earlier pushing every single person away. And
I got good reasons to do it.
Yeah.
And you won't appreciate me for how hard I'm working for us.
Yeah.
But the reality is I'm going to push this all away.
Yeah. Someday you'll appreciate it.
Yeah. Right? Yeah. Meanwhile, I'm going to resent you and be pretty irritated and confused and isolated. Yeah.
I think it goes, too, into that like systems conversation. I think when I think of these different dimensions of wellness, sometimes I utilize those as getting out of my own way, right? When it's because I do that same thing wrapped up in the day to day where you just kind of are going and being busy,
right?
Which can be projects at home, it could be family stuff, it could be work stuff that you're doing at home in order to avoid conversations.
Sure.
It's all of those things, but like when you take a second, take a break, and then break into one of those that you are not doing well.
It's hard for us to recognize the person next to me could be having their worst day ever.
Mm. Well, majority of the people that interact with first responders on a daily basis, that is their worst day.
This is a terrible day, and they're in the middle of it, right? They're just trying to tread water. They're just trying to figure it out. And when we get into a spot where other people's suffering is an inconvenience to us, then we end up doing what I refer to as kind of this self-betrayal of I see someone suffering, and it could be my spouse, could be my kid, it could be this person on the street, some citizen in the community. I see their suffering, but I don't – the part of me that got into this work where I want to be really responsive and really connected to the service and really do something that is positive and impactful that shifts for a lot of responders, and people's suffering ends up becoming, a pain in the ass.
Yeah.
And when we get into that kind of loop, this is when a lot of the responders tell me, that's when I knew that my mental health has changed. Is it the thing that used to bring me joy and satisfaction and the reason why I got into this career is now way in the background. And now, whether it's my supervisor or whatever, everyone feels like the enemy. Everyone feels like they're an idiot, or, add whatever adjective you want there. But those are those dark places that we get to sometimes that are pushing us closer and closer to this high risk thinking. But it creeps in slow, and sometimes we don't recognize it.
Yeah, and I think that's like a key factor is in this thinking is when you talk about the loss of joy and things they used to do. Mm-hmm. I think it's almost person for person. Like, I used to do this, and I used to love it. We're talking as simple as fishing, hunting, whatever.
Sure.
Right? Like, just going and doing something that brings them joy. Those events, either they haven't done them in a really long time, or they just no longer bring them joy.
Yeah. I've had a number of responders that are like, I just had my kid's birthday party the other day, and I hated the whole experience. Mm-hmm. Watching them be happy doesn't even faze me anymore. So I think, again, going back to the big picture of what we're talking about, I think there's a lot of those little signs. And I hope as we talk about it, it might spark some memories or some ideas, or maybe poke at or trigger a reaction from some of our listeners that there's lots of little things that just have accumulated over the course of our lives that basically, at the end of the day, leaves us pretty disconnected from who we are and where we want to be. And when we're in that spot and stay in that spot and don't get help for years, that pressure is just going to keep on building. So prevention is really about health. how do we get healthy and how do we manage some of these smaller issues as well as some of the big ones. But as we talk about preventing suicide, the reality is we have to slow down more often and look at some of the small stuff. We can all, you know, there's loads of committees, there's loads of seminars and meetings that are for big events, right? Shootings, different kinds of deaths, like those things get our attention. And I would say that is true for a percentage of our first responders that we work with. They would say that day that messed me up. And that's totally legitimate. And to be honest, they have no issue of going and getting help for that. For the big stuff.
Yeah.
But the reality is there's a lot of little beliefs. There's a lot of little, personal betrayals of our values. There's a lot of little things that we end up doing that just put us off track, put us off target, and they have us drift further and further away from who we want to be. And that's the stuff that ends up kind of biting people in the butt, is that they're just unhappy, struggling, and oftentimes, you know, quite literally drowning in a sea of really dark things. And that's I think one of the bigger things that ends up putting people at this high risk window.
Well, and let's really talk. I know you have some key points and some key pieces that are more solution based and that are that address specific actions on different subjects that you can do to help prevent these feelings, these emotions, these behaviors.
Right. Well, let's talk about ourselves for the first chunk of it, and then we can talk about how to help a loved one. But some of it overlaps quite a bit. I think as we talk about solutions, obviously the obvious one is getting some professional help. I think what is interesting is that a lot of our responders have some pretty strong opinions about medication. Mm. Depression, anxiety, they are almost a guarantee in the first responder world, especially if you are in this stoic, A-type, I'm good at nitpicking problems, and I'm not great at owning mine.
Yeah.
That is almost guaranteed for a lot of our responders, is that there is a wear and tear on your mental health when stoicism, being strong, never acknowledging issues, that stuff accumulates in some pretty toxic ways. And so if you're not taking advantage of a yearly check-in with someone, that's really not a lot. It's not much for most people. But finding a way to access some of your local support in your agency, EAPs, some are great, some are not great. But even if you're with a professional who is not great at their job, you are still taking some of the pressure out and you're still getting some of that shit out there.
Yeah. Well, I want to take away some of the power of depression and anxiety in general, because that is just a very human experience.
Right.
Like, right. That's the part that I want people to leave with, is like, a lot of people have that at one point or another. Now, they may not need medication like some do, or they may not, need to go to a therapist like some do. But if someone says, I've never been depressed or I've never been anxious, I'm pretty sure you're a liar.
Yeah, you're pretty committed to the lie at that point.
Yeah.
I think there's some good books out there, and maybe we can add some links for a couple of these books that are not trying to push, mental health therapy. But there's a lot of research that supports that you need community and positivity and friends and mindfulness and some other just nonverbal positive aspects that's going to help you feel a bit more grounded, a bit more stabilized. And so there are lots of ways, and there are good people in your life that actually care. They're curious. They may not know what to say. And if you remove the expectation of them being your therapist, if you just tell them what's actually going on and ask them to listen, the reality is they're probably going to follow your instructions and probably just shut up for a minute. And that's going to do you some good.
Yeah.
And I think there's that voice in our head that says that if we really get honest with people and tell them what's happening for us, that they're going to just run into the distance like they're on fire. And they're going to be so shocked and grossed out by what they've seen in you. We can't let that voice win. The reality is that they're usually going to do a pretty good job. They'll try to be attentive. They'll try to be engaged. And you might have to teach them how to respond to you. And I think that's a good one. I'm a big fan of that. Even if we meet a new therapist or engage in some kind of mental health support, we do need to tell people how to kind of sort us out.
Yeah, everyone's different.
Yeah.
That's the piece is like, talked about it forever, but there is no one size fits all handbook to dealing with people's issues.
Yeah. There's no therapist that leaves grad school and thinks, well, there's plenty that think they can read minds.
Yeah.
None of them actually can.
Yeah.
And I think there's this assumption and joke at times of, well, you're the doctor or you're the therapist. You tell me what to do. The reality is that's a huge waste of time. don't expect them to figure out any of that stuff. Tell them what you need. Tell them what's going on. And you may not know where to start, but I think having some very honest, direct conversations, friends, family, and just saying, hey, this is where I'm at. And it's fine if you're not in a spot where you want professional support, but it's fine to also say, hey, I don't need to lie about this other stuff either. Okay. So that would be a piece. Yeah, you have to take a look at where your substance abuse or your alcohol use might be. There's no way around it. That is a double-digit massive issue in the world of first responders. Is it drinking? Everyone's nervous about whether or not they would be labeled or considered an addict or an alcoholic. But the reality is when you are using substances and obviously alcohol to manage pain, sleep issues, stress, those are the gateways that get us into a spot where I need this thing to manage something that I cannot.
Yeah.
That has an impact. And again, regardless of the labels, take a look at whether or not you're leaning on those kinds of things to get through the day or the week or through a relationship. Taking a look at it, asking for an outside opinion, even considering some moderation and backing off from it, you're going to do yourself some real good if you can at least start to consider, how can I do less and how do I increase some resilience or some skills in another part of my life and not lean on a particular substance to do that for you. That leads to some really positive stuff.
Well, that's even, I think the secret in this community is the benzodiazepines as well. And they're, right. And people are taking them as prescribed. I want to be very clear there. A lot of people are taking them as prescribed, but when they try and stop, they realize what's happened.
Right.
And they can't stop
right
at that point, right? And it's high risk to quit medications like that on your own without any supervision. And people do it all the time because then they realize, you know, this has a hold of me. But that's the secret killer.
Right.
Is alcohol is very socially acceptable. Benzos leak into that secret hidden thing from a lot of people.
Yeah, great point. So as we go through the list a little bit, trauma. You know, one thing that Brad and I talk about in our trainings is we try and help people kind of do the arithmetic of how much exposure does the average first responder have to trauma over the course of their career. And the numbers are pretty uncomfortable.
Yeah.
If we're talking about the average person on the streets having three or four traumatic events in their life, and they might spend, you know, some solid time in therapy trying to sort it out. It's you know, we're talking tens of thousands of different sort of moments of all shapes and sizes. But there needs to be a proactive plan to start to manage that. And again, some of that does include therapy. But there are some good books out there that talk about what dysregulation is and how our nervous system works and how human it is. Like, this is not weird. This is a pretty reliable truth that when you're exposed to this many events over this amount of time with so little support or skill in managing that, the reality is it's going to be a guarantee that you're going to be experiencing some stuff. And that doesn't necessarily mean PTSD. There's lots of injuries out there that can be processed and overcome. And there are some things that may not ever get processed. They just might need some time to recover from. So there's good news out there when it comes to stress and trauma. There's lots of things we can do in terms of our nutrition, in terms of our health. There's different kinds of experiences that are about restabilizing your nervous system that can be incredibly quiet and very simple. And some of them might include a group of people that might help you navigate this stuff. And some of it might just be small readjustments to your schedule and to your routine that allow you to get into a place where you can release some of that tension that is building up in your body. And for some people, it's their soul and their general perspective in life. But there's some good practical things you can do. Some of it's about talking, and a lot of it is not, that can help you get to a different place. So I think that helps quite a bit.
Yeah, I was talking to the police executive research forum gentleman. And the interesting thing that he brought up about just trauma in general is that, you know, compared to 40 years ago, the amount of trauma that an officer or firefighter or EMT will see has increased because of the population. I mean, just vehicles, the amount of vehicles on the road, which then increases the amount of car crashes that you have to respond to, is just one small contributing factor why people are seeing more bodies and more critical incidents than they were 40 years ago. Gun violence has increased in certain cities a massive amount. It's gone down in other cities too. Domestic violence increased dramatically during COVID. Like all of these smaller, when you're talking about these tiny pieces, those tiny pieces have increased, which causes the person to see more than someone who was on the job 50, 60, 70 years ago.
Right. And then you add short-staffed.
Yes. Overworked.
Overworked. I'm in more debt. I need more overtime hours, mandatory overtime hours.
Yep. Riots.
Riots. The idea that, hey, I used to be able to go home from work and I used to get the thumbs up and how you doing from my neighbors. And there is this community betrayal where they feel like they're not welcome, they're not supported, on top of whatever administrative things where here they are learning about their mental health, learning that they need a little bit more support and their admin may not be on board. There's lots of these little factors that just contribute to the idea of what's the point?
Mm-hmm.
Which is, yeah, you do need to ask the question, what's the point?
Yeah.
You should have a solid answer for that.
Yeah.
What is the point? Why am I doing this? And there are great answers out there, but it does it's more than just a coffee talk.
Yeah.
It's a larger evaluation of how am I doing and how's the big picture of my life going. So I think there's good solutions in that realm. Again, every agency has got access to some free mental health support. Almost all agencies have a peer support team.
Yeah.
And those teams, as I've been to the trainings, the bare minimum of the training is someone's there to listen.
Yeah. And just, every time. That's the number one piece.
Right. And that's the part that is amazing, is it the amount of people that come to treatment that said, I've felt so alone. And it isn't until a year or two later they say, everybody else in my department also felt alone. And the more I actually talked and shared my story a little bit, people come out of the woodwork saying, like, man, that was me. And I've been there too. And I was in a dark spot. And this is what's going on. So this is a very large conversation. Not only in just departments and precincts, but just firehouses and all sorts of places. Like, there's a lot of misery going around, and it's just a human experience. It's not that our misery is better or worse than anybody's, but we're all in the middle of it. And that's, as soon as we actually open up some conversations, the reality is most people say, I got a little bit of that too. And just for a second, those little moments when we share and take a vulnerable step and acknowledge a part of our story, and someone else says, thanks for pointing at it, because I have a little bit of that too. We shed all sorts of this internal pressure and shame and fear and stigma just when those little moments happen. So you never really know until you do it. But yeah, can't say how important it is to just speak up and give people the benefit of the doubt and share a little bit, because the reality is there's probably someone not too far away that's willing to at least acknowledge that you're in a rough spot. Most of the time, they've got something to share as well. And lots of very accidental but very positive things have happened when people just say, you know what, I did talk to a counselor. And some of the biggest badasses out there who say that end up really doing some pretty positive stuff for their teams.
They're the biggest proponent.
Yeah.
Right. Really the guy are. You never, it's the way of the world and society. The guy you never thought would be the one to find the help, get the help, heal, ends up being the biggest proponent for it. And then other people start listening.
Yep. Happens all the time. So a couple other solutions is get out of your house.
That's harder than it sounds.
Yeah. You got to probably have a buddy or somewhere to kind of kick you out of the house. Spouses are anxious around this one sometimes, but when we are used to this self-defeating cycle of thoughts about nothing really matters. What's the point? I might just sit down here in the basement, or the garage is a typical place. I'm just going to have a few beers and just disconnect from all the pressure. Again, it comes from a good place. But the reality is that kind of isolation usually is jet fuel for some of the anxiety, depression, and some of the misunderstandings that are happening in relationships. And so getting out of the house can mean a lot of different things. It might be a support group. That's the cheesy therapist answer.
Mm-hmm.
But it might mean actually go on a date. It might join some kind of club. Go and do some kind of sports. Go and be around people. You still might not like any of them. But you've seen people smile, seeing people communicate, seeing other people is part of how we get out of that negative loop that it's just about me. So we don't really know, we can't really plan out all the details, but I am not talking about checking in with Facebook or Instagram and being on your phone more. Some people think they have this idea of this synthetic interpretation of being social and doing. Being on your phone for hours and hours is not helping you. There's loads of evidence that supports that you are getting sicker the longer you stay on that phone, the longer you let the algorithm guide where your time and attention is focused on. There's not a lot of good happening there, but it does mean something to put your phone down. Go out for a walk. Walk your dog. Use whatever excuse you want to, but get out of the house a little bit and start to move around. It's going to be good for probably some of the chronic pain.
Yeah.
It's going to be good for a number of things, but there's loads of research that says if you just get out in the sun and just breathe a bit more regularly, I mean, sure, there's the extremes of getting out that might include, you know, an ice bath or some of these other kind of activities that are a pretty cool challenge that does a lot of good for our systems. But there's some moderate to even really benign things that we can do on a daily basis that just gets us out of our funk and our routine. And if we can commit to those kinds of things, because realistically, I've seen plenty of folks who come and get treatment and they're like, well, I've tried going for a walk and it didn't work.
One walk.
Yeah. I'm like, I tried to do therapy once. I went to couples counseling once and it didn't work.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm thinking like, it's because your expectations are wildly off.
Mm-hmm.
So we have to commit to the bigger concept of being healthy, not just this quick fix. Ironically, the quick fixes is what gets us into this mess.
Yep.
The larger system improvements are really bring some of the hope and some of the optimism and some of the different solutions. I do want to acknowledge that getting some support with possible some financial debt.
Yeah, that's a big one.
That one is tough because there's loads of shame in that discussion. There's lots of folks who work their asses off only to recognize that, hey, the spending, and again, it could be impulsive because financial and nutritional stuff share a lot of issues.
Toys.
It's a lot about impulse. Yeah. I feel miserable, therefore I might eat or I might spend.
Yeah.
There's a lot of similarities in how we problem solve in that area. So getting some support, putting together a plan. There's a lot of folks that stay in a very unhealthy routine because they are committed to this weird treadmill of debt and struggle. And I see lots of guys who have been in their career for years longer than they needed to be.
Mm-hmm.
Because they did not have a financial plan and didn't know how to manage this whole retirement thing. And again, we're just not great at talking about that stuff in our culture.
Yeah. Well, it was the short-term side-by-side that they thought they were going to use every weekend on their days off.
Right.
That was going to bring them joy.
Right.
That has sat in the garage for 6 months or is broken down.
Right.
And they're paying $500 a month for it or something, you know.
Their wife's talking about it.
Yeah.
Their kids can't touch it.
Yep. Yep.
Yeah, there's a lot of those things that are the shiny objects in the moment, but end up being not quite what you hoped.
Yeah. The fix you figured out isn't actually the fix.
Right. Yeah. No, I think there's a lot of that. So a lot of this comes back to this conversation that we have a lot around here at the Chateau, where we have to probably zoom out once in a while and look at the larger balance question. Of is my life in balance? Am I putting the time and energy where it really needs to be? Oftentimes when we are in the thick of it, especially where we're in the middle of a lot of stress or a stress response system, we just get really myopic. We just get really stuck on some a couple of things like spending, like sex, like money. like other things, these things are going to be the thing that fix me. And when we get in those little places, we put a ton of expectations into that thing being it. And we often kind of recruit people to join us and to co-sign on the idea that this thing is going to be it. The opposite of that is very relevant in the conversation around prevention, because it's about how do I take a larger inventory of where my life balance is. The conversation that is usually not addressed for years is spirituality. The program is not a spiritual-based program, but the conversation about spirituality is not about religion necessarily or about who God is. That's not really the conversation. The conversation is, where does purpose and meaning and your identity, what is it rooted in? What gives you hope? How do you make sense of forgiveness? How do you make sense of grace and not just keeping track of every negative thing that's ever happened to you or that you've done to someone else? What is your system for alleviating that kind of pressure? And most people, to be honest, don't dedicate a lot of energy to that. And then they get to this point in their career where they need some extra help. And usually about 10, 12 days after they get there, they're like, my identity is rooted in all sorts of crazy stuff, and I do not like who I am. So if we're really trying to go solution-based on this kind of stuff, we're going to have to take a moment and look at that bigger picture of who do we want to be, and am I happy with that? And some of these larger conversations about what kind of a father or mother do I want to be? What kind of sibling am I? There's a lot of these identity questions that just don't really get addressed unless we dedicate some serious energy to it.
Yeah. Spirituality sounds like the easiest one.
Well, yeah.
Purpose.
Yeah.
Meaning.
It's one of those conversations like, I'm a little nervous about it, but I don't know if I've met anyone that's like really regretted having a conversation about identity.
Very true. Very true. But I think that that's, talk about being human again, I think that's the part that we seek out for our entire lives, and our purpose and meaning changes as we develop.
Right.
As
Which
we
is
get
great.
Older.
It's good news, but sometimes if we don't look at it more than once or twice in our lives, it can be a little intimidating. So I think that's, again, the joke around here is that people, you know, go to residential treatment and they think it's such a huge commitment, only to find out the majority of things that are going to make them happier in life are free.
Shocking.
It was not about the therapist, and it was not about the toys, and it was not about all these fancy other interventions. The reality is there's some quiet time with ourselves where we have to ask some hard questions and demand some decent answers. And there's tons of people that want to talk, that want to connect and want to relate to us. But those things we think are just for somebody else or for some other kind of exotic conversation or situation. And a lot of the stuff is pretty simple. So that's kind of the list I got.
No, that was great.
I think there's lots to it. And as always, what we talk about around here is no one can put this plan together for you. We none of us want to be in a scenario where someone walks into our lives and say, this is what you have to do, and this is when you have to do it, or here's all the advice I have. Most of us put up either literally or mentally a middle finger and think, you can't tell me what to do, and I'm a grown-ass man, adult, and whatever.
Yep.
But the reality is that no one's coming to do this for us. We have to own this work. We have to own how unhappy we might be. We have to own that, hey, we've made a mess. And if we get past the shame and guilt of it, the reality is that we're all kind of in a mess. But there are some practical things we can slow down and get working on that actually is going to make a positive impact. But that ownership is the good and the bad news of this whole process. The good news is you have tons of options within your control. The bad news is you have tons of options within your control. And you're the only person that's in the way, usually.
No, 100%. I think I get asked a ton. Like, is change actually possible?
Sure.
I don't think we could do this job or your profession without believing that that is a possibility.
Totally agree.
Ben, thank you. I appreciate the time you spent. Do you have any, you've imparted a ton of wisdom and knowledge and everything like that. Is there anything you want to leave the people with?
For those in the middle of it, hang in there. I think you're not as alone as you think. Man, there's so many people that are cheering for you. We often can't see it We live in a culture where if someone gives you a compliment, most of us blow it off immediately. But I just want to just acknowledge that there are people ahead of you in this process of trying to be better, and all of them think it's worth it. You're worth it. The process is worth it. And the discomfort that is around the corner as you consider making some changes in the process of saving your life, they're worth it. So I think that we often get stuck in the shame and the fear, but the reality is you are worth it. You always have been. This process is going to work as you dedicate some energy to it. But just know that there's a lot of folks cheering for you.
Absolutely. And that's the part I want to leave as well. If you are, you know, struggling with suicidal ideation, depression, anxiety, those kind of things, I think this whole conversation is reach out, talk to somebody. You know, if you are in immediate crisis, there is the suicide hotline. Dial 988. You can text 988. You can chat. You can do anything you need. And there are people out there that will answer and will help. Thanks, Ben.
Thank you.
Chateau Health and Wellness is a 16-bed treatment facility nestled in the foothills of the Wasatch Mountains in Midway, Utah. Chateau's First Responder Resiliency Program is designed to treat the unique challenges and issues that first responders encounter in the course of their careers. Chateau's comprehensive and highly individualized approach to treatment addresses more than just the presenting issues. It addresses the why. Each of their seasoned, trauma-trained, and culturally competent therapists utilize evidence-based, specialized therapies to treat trauma at its core and enable clients to begin the healing process while developing a resilient and healthy relationship with stress. Chateau Health and Wellness is trusted by departments and agencies from around the country to treat responders and veterans. In fact, it is one of only a handful of facilities nationwide that is vetted and approved to treat members of the Fraternal Order of Police. For more information or to speak to a representative, go to chateaurecovery.com or call 888-507-5031.